So, this afternoon's session is called Representation and Navigation. And essentially, this is going to be about the Philosophy of Language. And it ties into this morning's session because what I was trying to sort of say in that session is that freedom is not simply about having capacities, but it depends upon a certain very specific set of capacities. And if you looked at the Brandon text I sent, he gives a kind of rough outline of this set of capacities for tracking inferential relations between sentences and thereby keeping track of one's practical and theoretical commitments, being this kind of essence of rational agency. I endorse this story basically, but I think it's important to kind of situate it within a broader history of thinking about thought and language, and so I'm going to try and again, just like I did this morning, present you with a sort of dialectic of the development of the philosophy of language, and in doing so then we can get to thinking more about the specific kind of capacities that are at the core of freedom. So if the other name for my first session was the dialectic of freedom, this is in a certain sense the freedom of dialectics, the particular kind of, the freedom of the concept, right? Freedom of the conceptual domain, which is a crucial part of practical freedom. Right, I am, in the course of doing this, going to attempt to give you a complete history of the possible language. Obviously not an easy thing to do. Please do ask questions if you have problems, and I will attempt to make things as compressed and explicable as possible. So, just as this morning, I have a few distinctions just to kind of orient what I was doing with freedom. I've got some distinctions, a few more, to orient what I'm doing with representation. So, these are some crucial sort of oppositions or relations that need to be thought through. So, there's the relationship between language and thought. It's a crucial question within the philosophy of language and philosophy of thought, because there is a whole tradition which thinks that you need to think thought independently of language in order to understand language, and there's a whole tradition that thinks the opposite, that you can only understand thought through language. And there are various ways of configuring things, but it's a crucial opposition for understanding how it is to be developed. Inference and reference. So the difference between inferring one sentence from another and understanding what a sentence is supposed to refer to in the world. These are important because essentially these are the two sort of semantic concepts that, well, along with truth, these are the semantic concepts that kind of guide the tradition. So, just to kind of bring you over to, I've got like a prehistory of linguistics here, and feel free for anybody who knows linguistics better to kind of correct me here. But the linguistics sort of grows out of the philosophy of thought, the study of form, the study of logic, philology and rhetoric, at least. I'm going to say something about philosophy of thought and logic. Importantly, these concepts of inference and reference are the dominant concepts within the pictures of thought presented by empiricism and rationalism. So in empiricism, reference is the dominant concept. You understand the content of thought in terms of the sort of experiential where they can, the ideas connect to the things in the world that are experienceable. Whereas rationalism, it's very much about the connections between the concepts that are important. So in Spinoza, this is particularly evident. This is more sort of very much relational conception of how concepts are figured into. Third important orient distinction, meaning use. Meaning will be like a crucial concept here. What is meaning? There's a variety of answers to this because it's not as easy as it might seem, given how familiar the term meaning is. And use, what is use? Well, actually, this is another tricky one because some people, when they talk about linguistic usage, talk about a very, very narrow part of linguistic, like, this is pragmatics. The discipline of pragmatics and linguistics has a tendency to focus upon what it thinks the pragmatic excess of language is. So they have a certain conception of how language works, and it's like, well, what's left over? Like, the awkward bits of, like, ambiguity and, like, understanding speaker intention and stuff like that, that's pragmatics. Whereas there is another way of looking at the tradition, which says that rather than having to tap use on meaning, meaning is use, to use Wittgenstein's phrase, and so pragmatics ends up being massively expanded into the whole study of the use of words and how meaning gets constituted out of that. Finally, there is a distinction between form and natural conceptions of language. And that's basically the distinction between, like, the study of logic and the study of natural languages, which, you know, came out of philology. So there's an important split within the study of language in syntax, semantics, and pragmatics, between studying formal languages like those used by logic and mathematics and those used by natural languages. And there's an important series of transits across this frontier where tools developed to be formal languages get applied to natural languages and vice versa. And I'm going to explain that a bit. Right, so there are four kind of guiding oppositions that will structure the sort of dialectic you're going to go through. A few more important distinctions. I've already mentioned a little bit. Distinction between syntax, semantics, and pragmatics. And these are the sort of three major sort of sub areas of linguistics, but also again, they appear in logic to a certain extent. Just to give you a sense of what they study, let's take the core element of pragmatics that I'm interested in, which is assertion. Assertions are truth claims. Saying something, you know, Kant is the most important philosopher in history. That's an assertion, right? But it is a use of a particular syntactic token, a sentence. We can look at, rather than my action there of asserting, we can look at the syntactic token I have used within that action. It's a sentence. But at the same time, you want to say that use of that syntactic token expressed a thought. It had content. And the study of that content is semantics. And to give the third thing there, it's proposition. So you say, in an assertion, I use a sentence to express a proposition. Right? And it's important to demystify this because one of the big debates throughout the history of philosophy of language has been whether we need propositions at all. Why can't we just talk about sentences? And most of the objections to talking about propositions are basically anti-metaphysical. They're like, oh, these propositions, they're these weird metaphysical things. Why do we have them? And to be fair, there is a lot of metaphysical. There are plenty of people who conceive these metaphysically, but you don't need to. A very simple way of thinking about propositions is simply that you can use different sentences to say the same thing. Right? You can use different sentences to say the same thing. And different people can use the same and different sentences to express the same thing. So there's some criteria of identity going on here. Right? And once you've got criteria of identity, you can have an equivalence class, and you can abstract a new object that you can talk about. Just straightforward and formal. So a good example of this is, like, two people can point in the same direction, right? You've got a criteria of identity, which is like parallelism, like pointing parallel, right, basically with the same vector. And that means there is this thing, a direction, that they're both, you know, engaging with. Similarly, two different people kind of search the same proposition. It's like pointing in the same direction. So this is quite useful from a navigation perspective. Like being able to say, well, I'm saying the same thing as you. Or rather saying, I disagree with what you're saying, pointing in the opposite direction, right? This is about orienting ourselves within the space of reasons. And just as we can talk about orientations within, you know, ordinary space, there's nothing strange about talking about orientations in logical space. Right. Final threefold distinction and methodological principle. So the final threefold distinction is between three different dimensions of content that come up in the history of philosophy in which were identified and then split apart and important. So, and the epistemic dimension. See, the three different ways of looking at propositions as things that can be true. So there's epistemic, distinction between a priori and a posteriori truths. So classically, we see, like, for instance, the truths of mathematics, people's Google 4 is a priori, you don't have any experience to know it. Whereas, you know, England is terrible at football. You know, it's something you need empirical knowledge, you know, it's a posteriori. There's a semantic distinction between analytic and synthetic truths, which is roughly truths that are supposedly true in virtue of their meaning, and truths that are true independently of their meaning. So the classic example from Quine is all bachelors are married men, right? That just seems to be like the definition of the word bachelor. It's just true if you know what bachelors are. And again, you know, England is terrible at football, although some people might think is part of the definition. It's not. And then finally, there is a modal distinction between necessity and possibility. And again, the classic example uses here a mathematical propositions versus, you know, other ones. But the interesting thing is that although for a lot of the history of philosophy, people thought that a priori, analytic, and necessary were essentially convergent. If something was a priori, it was analytic and necessary. And if something was a posteriori, it was synthetic and possible. One of the probably the biggest kind of conceptual shift in analytic philosophy of language in the 20th century is the realization that you can split these things apart. And the important thing to understand is that essentially what these all are dimensions of variation. So getting back to what Reza was saying, Caligari, these are dimensions of variation in relation to which you can get invariance. Right? So a priori, analytics, necessary, certainly sort of kind of linguistic invariance. And it turns out the dimensions of variation aren't exactly the same, so the invariants aren't the same. But we can quickly go back to that. Finally, the methodological principle that I put in the abstract, and so I'm bound to it, is what Brandon called logical expressivism. Brandon's logical expressivism is basically a claim about what logical vocabulary is. So the relationship between the formal languages of logic and the natural languages, which have these logical vocabulary. When we do formal logic, we extract logical vocabulary from natural languages and try to kind of systematize it. And then we can reapply it to those natural languages. What are we doing in doing this? Well, Brandon's answer is basically this is semantic self-consciousness. Right? In the sense that I was working at before. It's becoming explicitly aware of the principles underlying the way in which we infer. So the idea is that I presented that schema of, you know, perception, inference, action. You don't need to understand the rules you're using to make inferences, to transit between sentences, in order to do it. You can just be consciously inferring. But to be self-consciously inferring is to use logical vocabulary to say what you could previously do. So instead of just intuitively going from the claim that today is Wednesday that tomorrow is Thursday, you were able to extract the inferential schema underlying that and say, if a day is Wednesday, then the next day is Thursday, right? It's a general principle that can be. So, you know, it relates to what the example I gave yesterday regarding tall and small, right? You know, you can articulate the inferential relationship between them. So if X is taller than Y, then Y is smaller than X, right? But both two terms are inferentially connected. But you can just implicitly understand that, or you can have the vocabulary that enables you to articulate it. Now, the thing I'm going to do in focusing on the analytic tradition of the philosophy of language is sort of focus on this formal natural relationship and the transits it enables. And this principle is my kind of methodological way of focusing that. It's the lens through which to look at those transits. Because just as you can see the logical vocabulary providing self-consciousness, it's also possible, this is not Brandon's term, this is mine, it's also possible to see it as encouraging semantic false consciousness. So it's easy in finding a particularly powerful formalism to thereby ignore things that cannot be seen within that formalism. You can get bound to a particular vocabulary, and in doing so, you lose semantic content. In fact, you kind of separate syntax, semantics, and pragmatics in a way that makes everything abstract in the Hegelian sense. And so I'm going to show how basically set theory, as we talked about yesterday, has been responsible for a certain amount of semantic false consciousness.
Right.
Okay. Just to very quickly go over this prehistory again. So in the philosophy of science, you've got empiricism and rationalism, which can be kind of focusing on reference and inference. General idealism, coming out of Kant. The important innovation of Kant, as I mentioned earlier, is this focus upon the judgment, which is to say, upon the proposition, right? Rather than focusing on the terms that the propositions are constituted out of. The other interesting tradition here is phenomenology, coming out of Searle. Plenty of work post to Searle on the phenomenology of language. Personally, I don't think it's very good, but it is an important tradition that just kind of point out. In logic, it begins with Aristotle, it goes through scholasticism, and that logic is all term logic. It's a logic which focuses upon a doctrine of terms, which is to say, like concepts like moral and Socrates, and then tries to understand inference in terms of how you combine those into judgments. So you start with terms, goes to judgments, and then to inference. This is kind of developed by Paul Royal, but then you kind of turn towards and Looker understands it, and James understands it a lot better. The kind of Boole and the kind of geometricization of sort of propositional logic, and then the real logical explosion happens with Frege and Peirce, who not only do they follow the sort of Kantian line of focusing on the proposition first, but they invent what are called quantifiers, or rather iterated quantifiers, which enable you to say things like for all, for some, most, and express things like, it sounds weird, but until Freudian and Peircean innovations, we couldn't really formalise what it is to say everyone loves someone. It's a first year logic example that always gets tried out, because there's a crucial ambiguity. Either you can say, well, there is a single person who everybody loves, or for every person, there is a particular person that they love. So it's either one super loved person, or everybody just happens to love a different person. Right? And that's a problem of the scope of the quantifiers, everyone and some. Right? If you get them wrong, you get it completely different. But in natural language, it seems like we're expressing it in the same way. Until that point, you couldn't disambiguate those things. So that's a little example of how like a little logical innovation creates an interesting semantic form of self-punishment.
Yeah.
Okay. The other linguistic traditions I should probably mention, so this is like moving from prehistory into history, are obviously Saussure and Structuralism. Which I think there's some interesting things to say about. I'm not going to say them, but you know, I'm not entirely ignorant of it. But I'm basically the problem with structuralism is it was kind of interesting when it happened, and then diverted into something which was very it became a degenerating research program, in my opinion. So these ways in which you can graft the original ideas of the more modern frameworks, but when people tell me that, like, oh, if I want to just understand language and just read McCann, I don't know whether to laugh or cry, because it's not a very powerful framework for talking about language, simply. And I'll show you why. Structuralism, I've already mentioned phonology is kind of part of the prehistory. I suppose the other big thing is Chomsky and Chomsky in programming syntax. Again, this isn't something I'm a particular expert on. I know enough about it to dislike it. The important thing is that Chomsky is quite explicit in saying that semantics is impossible, or even worse, he retreats from that and says maybe semantics will become possible in like 100 years. But like for now, all we can do is syntax. And what this does is it treats syntax abstractly in that Hegelian sense. It's like, oh, we just know what we mean by noun phrase and verb and things like this, and where we can construct a sort of transformative grammar on the basis of that. But like actually, if you want to understand those grammatical categories, you're not going to be able to understand them without their relations to semantics and pragmatics. Like, if you... Well, basically, you've just got in with an implicit conception of grammatical categories, and to make it explicit, you need the whole trinity of representation of vocabulary. Right. Now, okay, prehistory framework sorted. Is everybody basically happy with that? Ish. Happy-ish? Any crucial questions? Or okay.
So if you're talking about prehistory and linguistics, I think one major source is grammar, starting from Greek through medieval.
Yeah, I think.
And so there's a whole tradition of linguistics that has its source in grammar that would sort out your
linguistics. Yeah, you're right. You're totally right.
And to the sides like philology, we very much at poetics.
What, sorry?
Poetics.
Is that important in the same from rhetoric? Well, I suppose that I was not the thing, so very easy. Okay. So poetics. I know there's kind of interrelations between all of these things as well.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's important interrelations between these things as well, so this is like a gear to a condensation of attempt just to kind of signpost what I'm not going to talk more about.
I understand.
It's very important. I mean, I suppose the other thing here is semiotics. And that kind of comes out of verse, whereas the tradition I'm going to be talking about comes out of Frege, but there's interesting ways of trying to, and hopefully, well, when we get to answer on the presentation tomorrow, we can maybe look at that integration. Right. Okay. The analytic tradition. And the important thing to remember about philosophy is that the philosophy of mind, basically there are two key core parts of the analytic philosophy. One is philosophy of language, the other is philosophy of science. If you want to talk about philosophy of science, talk to Fabio. I'm just going to explain to you the philosophy of language. And as I mentioned before, everything kicks off with Frege. And the reason everything kicks off with Frege is it starts in logic. It starts in formal languages. So, logic and Frege. And I've already mentioned that what Frege's big initial logical discovery is quantifiers. But he makes two sort of additional sort of contributions to semantics as such that have massive consequences. So one is basically it's an extension of this, the idea of the kind of functional conception of the truth functions and the other sense reference distinction. And I know this all sounds very dry, but it's kind of important and all. Truth functions. Right, what Frege does is, and this is what he was interested in, was trying to describe mathematical language. He was only interested in formal language. And what Frege did was to treat predicates. So you know the classic propositional structure is subject predicate. Right, what he did was to treat predicates like, you know, X is a dog. Or more appropriately, you know, X is an integer, right? As being functions in the mathematical sense. So f, x. And a function takes an argument and produces a value, right? And he thought that essentially predicates take objects as arguments and return truth or falsity as values. They point to truth or falsity. So what this means is that because you can think of functions in set theoretical extensional terms, but this is basically equivalent to saying that predicate is collapsible into a set. So say you've got this X is an integer, right? It's a function. Right? It takes any number and will return a truth or falsity, yes, no, if it's an integer or not. Right? But another way of representing that information exactly is just the set of integers. Right? Right? Either it's in the set or it's not. So this is highly set theoretical, and it basically works for mathematics. But again, it works for mathematics in this kind of retrospective way. Now, quantifiers basically are seen as functions on predicates. So, like a quantifier like x, 5x, right? If you add f there, if you substitute f in for phi, that will return truth if everything in the domain you're quantifying over is f. That doesn't sound so great. I'm trying to give a better way of describing it. So it's generally easier to use an example like for everything, if f is x, then f is g, right? So for everything, if it's a philosopher, then it's a drunkard, right? That's the example I was always given in that I love this stuff. And basically, this enables you to take predicates and logical operators and construct what's called a well-formed formula. So imagine that's not there. And then, if that formula is true for every x in the domain you're quantifying over, you know, intuitively, everything, right, then it will return true. So you get this hierarchy of functions, whereby you have functions that end up taking functions as values and returning truth. And in fact, Frege ends up creating this conceptual hierarchy where you end up with functions over functions over functions and functions over functions. It goes on and on and on and on and on. And that's what influences Russell to create type theory in and so forth. Right, now, what the important thing to remember is this is all extensional. It's all set theoretical. It can always be collapsed back into sets. This is where Frege's work is in tension with himself, because Frege develops this sense reference distinction, which basically shows you why natural language doesn't work in the way that at least the sort of mathematical language Frege was interested in works. So the classic example is the morning star is the evening star. Morning star equals evening star. Okay, Hesperus is phosphorus, right? Now, both of these things are Venus. But until we had a good picture of the solar system, they were referred to in different terms, because you saw one in the morning and saw one in the evening. Could have been different, right? Now, what Frege sort of points out is that is very different from the morning star is the morning star. Right? If I tell you the morning star is the morning star, you go, yeah, no shit. It's completely informative. Right? It's you know, epistemically inert. But that, knowing that the morning star is the evening star, is actually quite useful. Like, and in fact, the same applies within mathematics itself, right? If you look at, like, you know, so really, really trivial example, you know, 2 + 3 + 5, right? 2 + 3 is actually a singular term. 2 + 3 is like a name. It's that you're saying, like, 2 + 3, the name for that is 5, right? And it might look like that's particularly trivial, but like pretty much anything that was on this side of the like really, really complicated mathematical formulas, it will be informative when you learn that they are equal to a particular kind of number of other mathematical. So that there's something informative going on here, and that means we can't just say that the meaning of the morning star and the evening star is the object that they refer to. We have to say that there's some difference between these two dimensions of meaning, sense and reference. The sense of the word meaning star, sorry, meaning star, morning star, has to be different from its reference. Now, the reason that this is in tension with this stuff about functions is that basically it's similar to what we were talking about, the difference between category theory and sets before. What Frege basically does is attempt to capture sense using reference. So he distinguishes sense and reference. He makes this really interesting conceptual maneuver and then ends up trying to think sense in terms of reference. And in doing so, causes a whole tradition of philosophy of language to be born. And I'm better to learn how that works. So Frege is crucial. I'll just very, very briefly mention the other important logical figures to think about. The other is Russell. Russell is crucial for Descriptions. High theory. And his batshit theory of propositions. Right, so really, really quickly, Russell picks up on Frege, picks up all this functional stuff. He's not interested in the sense of reference distinction. In fact, for Frege, the sense of a proposition, so when I say, you know, fire is a dog, the sense of that proposition refers to its truth value. Like the reference of a proposition is true or false, right? But the proposition is the sense of the sentence. It's the sense, as opposed to the reference, which is truth or false. For Russell, the proposition, so understanding the meaning of the sentence, is actually the things it talks about. So when I say Fido is a dog, that proposition is composed of Fido and doghood, right? The universal and the particular combined, that actual structure in the world, that's the meaning. It's highly metaphysical. That encourages a whole different approach to people, which is ludicrous, but we'll get to that. His theory of descriptions is quite important because basically Russell had this sort of argument with Meinong thought that anything we could talk about had to actually in some sense have being. So the true king of France, even though there is no king of France, the golden mountain, the round square, even impossible things, you've got all of these things had to have some kind of metaphysical status. And Russell, given that he had this very metaphysical conception of meaning, didn't want to have to include these things within his metaphysics. And so he provided us with what he calls the theory of descriptions, which basically just translates a singular term like the King of France into something that basically has a uniqueness condition. So like there is one unique king thing which satisfies being the King of France, and it is, so if you say the King of France is bald, it turns out that in the truth conditions of that, you're seeing that there is something that is the King of France. But of course, that's false, so the whole sentence in the world is false. We can go into that further. Type theory is, you know, I mentioned this hierarchy of functions. That's Russell's attempt, and it's in Principia Mathematica, and it's crucial to the foundations of logic. Or James can tell you more about it. It's an attempt to type all of these variables. So you think all these functions have variables, they take objects. Well, it turns out that if you just think that variable ranges over everything you can possibly think of, you end up with problems. Classically, you end up with Russell's paradox, where you go, does the set of all sets contain itself? If it does, it doesn't. If it doesn't, it does. Right, so you need to make sure that the variable can't range over everything you can possibly specify, and that's Russell's kind of innovation, was to take Frege's functional machinery and to like make it into this prism for reference. Like everything you can possibly refer to is kind of worked out recursively in advance. It's very problematic, but it's precisely the kind of gesture of set theory. The gesture is, right, crap, let's completely delimit all possible variation. Let's work out how we box everything off. Right, Russell. And then two more figures, and I'll stop the logic. And that's Tarski and Genson. Tarski, so the crucial thing with Frege and Russell is that they were still doing what's called axiomatic logic. So their definitions of what all the logical operators, like, you know, conditional and not, however you want to write them, they were all specified axiomatically, like, in, so you just stipulate it, basically. And you end up with this big question: well, why these definitions? Why should we think that these definitions capture the meaning of and or if and then? And this was quite important because actually the Freudian way of defining a lot of these things is highly counterintuitive. So just take the conditional. You get these things called the paradoxes of material implication, where for example, any conditional with a false antecedent in the Freudian system is true. So if I say, you know, if the moon is made of green cheese, then Prince Charles will be king. That's true. Because the two sides of the conditional don't need to relate to one another in any way, as long as the beginning is false. So there were all kinds of questions regarding how to fix them, how to understand the meaning of these things rather than just defining how they work. And that's really when you get semantics in logic, proper semantics of formal languages. And that's Tarski. Tarski introduces this thing called model theory, and it's an attempt to basically map the meaning of these logical terms onto structures, particularly sets. Luca and James could explain model theory a lot better than I could, but it's kind of crucial to understand that this was a formal innovation for trying to explain the meanings of logical vocabulary that then got picked up and moved in a natural language. The other person to talk about is Genson, because Genson represents, so if the Tarski is model theory, which is basically just sets and null sets, Genson invents proof theory. And what's important about proof theory is that it bridges the gaps between syntax, semantics, and pragmatics in logical systems. What Genson tried to do was to find ways of describing the syntax of proof. So instead of looking at syntax as being something which is restricted to sentences, like the internal structure of the sentence, let's study the structure of the way in which we infer between sentences. Right? You've got the syntax of that, which is actually, in a certain sense, a very, very, very formal abstract pragmatics of proof. And this proof theory stuff is incredibly important because it really forms the basis of modern understandings of computing. It's really, 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 really important. I should say that what happens later is you get this thing called proof theory semantics. And proof theory semantics is the attempt to understand the content of what's said in terms of these proof structures, rather than just sets of any kind. How am I doing for time? We only start at 20 past. I think I've got another 20 minutes.
I'm not brilliant.
Okay. just a very quick sidebar here. I don't know if anybody knows the Chinese room argument from John Searle. You know, he has this whole argument, and his whole argument is that basically you can never get semantics out of syntax, because you always need this homunculus. This intentional homunculus, this primitive intentionality in order to give your symbols meaning. And that's crap. And one way of looking at why it's crap is because it has this kind of artificial distinction between syntax and semantics. And the artificialness of it comes precisely in ignoring pragmatics, which in a certain sense that it's just you can't get semantics out of the syntax of the sentences. Okay, maybe I can't, but if you give me proof syntax, if you give me the syntax of the operations between the sentences, how they're used within context, then I might be able to give you semantics, and that's basically a certainly what you mean to use. Right. Okay, that is the logical origins of analytic philosophy of language. Now to natural language. So, what we said, that is a kind of Freudian and Russellian approach. but really the sort of dominant tradition in the Analytic philosophy of language. Is model theoretics.
You're talking about Montague?
Before Montague, basically Davidson. Okay. Okay, here's ignore that for now, right? Like, the two big figures beginning understanding of natural language would probably be Carnap, then Quine, and in a certain sense Sellis, who is a lot less read until recently. Right, so the crucial thing to understand about Carnap is Carnap introduces this distinction between intention and extension. And this is something that was talked about yesterday. And the thing is this was Carnap's attempt to collapse the conflict inside of Frege. It was an attempt to reformulate the sense-reference distinction in purely set-theoretical functional terms. So if you think in Frege, it's important to remember that the sense, the proposition, isn't actually a function, or at least in a certain sense it isn't. What you get in... Okay, that's perhaps a bit wrong way of putting it. I'll just put it in this way. What Carnap tries to do is to extend Frege's functional machinery in order to try and encompass meaning. So basically what he does is to incorporate a specific dimension of variation, which is to say possibility. Right, so... classically, you get, say, two extensionally equivalent predicates. This is Quine's example, creature with heart, creature with kidneys, right? In actual fact, there is no creature that has a heart that will not have kidneys as well. Evolutionarily, these things have gone together, right? But we think that those two things mean different, have different meanings. And Carnap will go, yeah, they have different meanings because they have different intentions. And intentions end up being functions from possibilities to truth models. And so, because there are some possible worlds in which it's the case that there are some things that hold kidneys without hearts or otherwise the other, or at least you can think in that way, we can distinguish the meanings. And this is the basis of what will become possible world semantics. But it's important to see that if Frege you have this like this tension between the sense reference distinction and its functional apparatus, Carnap collapses it. Quine and Sellis, oh shit, fuck Wittgenstein. This is important. Take Wittgenstein for more important than Sellis for now, because in many ways Sellis just picks it from Wittgenstein. So what Quine and Wittgenstein do is that they recapture this meaning of these propositions. Right? So Quine, I should say, was one of the people who thought we didn't need propositions. He was like, just talk about sentences, you don't need these weird things. Right? What he was interested in was saying, how do we describe language just in terms of behaviour? And essentially he put some pragmatic challenges to semantics, basically saying, in the end of the day, you can't work out determinate meanings for what people are saying because no amount of their previous behaviour will distinguish either what they mean by the propositions they're putting forward or what they're referring to in the singular terms that compose them. Quine sort of like challenges both meaning and reference quite manifoldly. Basically, Wittgenstein does a very similar thing. Wittgenstein basically has a challenge where the rule-following argument in private language. he puts forward these arguments that essentially amount to the same idea that really language is a normative issue, and so you need to understand how sort of the norms governing linguistic practice constitute meaning, and these always exceed any particular set of linguistic behaviour that might be interested.
Okay. So you have rules.
Right, okay. I did say that I'm trying to do a comprehensive history and I might be also including some. Anyway. So, major traditions that come out of model theory. And this basically has two different strands. And then cryptic. And that goes in to like possible words and numbers. And neuroscience stuff. Right. But the important thing is that basically Davidson was a student of Quine's, he thought Quine was right in certain ways, wrong in others. And he thought that basically what Quine needed was Tarski. And Tarski's theory of truth. So Davidson comes up with this incredibly sort of like supposedly profound idea that in order to explain the meaning of the phrase "know his wife," what you need is you need a T schema in which you say "know his wife," right? It's true if and only if "know his wife," right? That's explained the meaning of "know his wife." Because it's specified as truth conditions completely. And I still get kind of like incredibly surprised how far this went within the academy. Like this Davidsonian semantics is still like dominant in certain places, and basically the thing is that what virtually everybody realizes is that the truth functional conception, the conception of meaning as truth conditions, doesn't work. Like it gives you sort of necessary conditions for differentiating meanings, but not sufficient ones. And there are two responses to that with the model theory tradition. One is the kind of Kripkean response, which is to say, well, let's complicate our model theory. Let's have a more complex conception of the sort of set theoretic variations we're looking at, and let's add more functions. Let's have more domains of variation and more functions of them, and so we'll try and capture this excess of meaning over truth. And the other approach, which is Davidson's approach, is just to say, it's to sort of say, well, truth conditions are good enough. That's fine. We don't really need anything more. Like all that stuff, that's just kind of like pragmatics and metaphor and that sort of thing. So I'm being incredibly cruel here, but given the fact that like the Davidsonian paradigm has gone on for like decades, I think I'm just about it. So model theory is the dominant tradition, and it is basically the attempt to set theoretical capture here. And the important thing about Kripke is the other sort of logical but also semantic.
Pete, though, isn't it worth just mentioning that the point of Davidson is to get rid of correspondence?
Okay.
And particularly when you go down to like Horridge.
Say it's okay, yeah.
So in some sense, it does do. But what it does something vaguely important.
One way of representing it is it basically Davidson-Sorian semantics is an attempt to do truth theoretical semantics without
substantive truth,
without reference,
without like any spurious metaphysics.
Yeah, okay. But it ends up like it ends up promising so much and delivering so little. Whereas like we could talk about this more. I'll go. So there's a certain sense in which Davidson is a more pragmatic approach to model theory coming out of Quine. Whereas what Kripke does, Kripke So you know what I haven't mentioned? There's this distinction between axiomatic logic and semantic approaches to logic. What Kripke does is to move from an axiomatic approach to modal logic. So modal logic is this stuff. Box and diamond, right? Necessarily and possible, right? In reducing explicit modal ways of talking about necessity and possibility. However, it turns out there are a whole bunch of different ways to axiomatize the way these work. These were like worked out roughly by C.I. Lewis. And what Kripke did was to show how to provide a semantics, like Tarski, for these, which doesn't exactly tell you which ones to pick, but it tells you what you're doing in picking different action sets. And so instead of you just make a choice, it actually tells you what the choices sort of mean in a certain sense. He does this by, basically, this is the idea of possible worlds. He formalizes the Carnapian intuition, which is to say, necessarily P means true, P is true in all possible worlds. P is true everywhere. And possibly P means P is true somewhere. And it's more complicated than this because he adds this idea of an accessibility relation. So a Kripke model is a set of possible worlds. And what a possible world is, basically, is like a set of sentences. It's like a maximal description of what the world is like, which is consistent. So everything. So you can get a new possible world by taking a conception of the actual world and just saying, well, that's true and that's false and that's true and that's... So you change what's true and what's false, you've got a new possible world, great. So a Kripke model is a whole range of these sets of maximally consistent sentences, and then you have this thing called an accessibility relation. And if the accessibility relation is symmetric, transitive, and reflexive, you have really, really simple modal logic in which if something is necessarily P, then it's just necessarily P. Right? Turns out if you change those accessibility relations, you start introducing additional structure into the space of possible worlds, and everything goes a bit haywire. I won't explain that, but it's just an example of how the semantic, the addition of semantic structure complicates and lets you understand kind of these things. Basically, when Kripke, up until Kripke, virtually everyone in analytic philosophy was incredibly suspicious of modal language. So it all comes out of Hume. Hume sort of says that necessary and possibility, that just doesn't mean anything. It's just all there is the actual. Right? And as soon as Kripke comes around and gives this formalism, suddenly everybody's, like, possibility is everywhere. It's used for everything. Modal logic is just, like, is you know, ambrosia to analytic philosophy language. And what happened then was the development of this within natural language. And basically this was just a formalisation of the Carnapian idea. You treat a proposition or a sentence basically as being a function from a possible world to a truth value. Right? So again, sentence like say England, let's go with England as a shape football, right? That the intention of that proposition, which is supposed to constitute its meaning, is a function from a world you happen to be in to whether or not it's true or not. So here it's true. In the world, it might be false. Again, what you can do with this, because this is all set theoretically tractable, is you can just collapse it down to a set. You can say that, well, the meaning of a proposition is just a set of possible worlds. And this means you end up with this kind of really weird metaphysical conception of meaning. This is David Lewis, where to believe something, right, to believe that England are crap at football, is to have this kind of metaphysical relationship to a set of possible worlds. Right? And for those of you who are interested, for those of us who are interested in, say, the relationship between meaning and use, this is awful. Because, like, how are you supposed to think about what this set means for actual linguistic practice? It completely pulls semantics away from pragmatics. But it gets very complicated, and they do have certain ideas, they are able to describe certain linguistic structures and so on. Even though the methodology is a bit dodgy, you want to pay attention to it. And finally, there's this kind of like neo-Russellian tradition which is sort of where Kripke himself lies, and they're the people who, like I said, for Russell, the meaning of propositions is actually the things themselves. Which basically say you have a metaphysical definition of meaning. Neo-Russellians do something like this. They basically want to say that either through metaphysics or through like cognitive psychology, you can just stipulate what propositions are. So for like Scott Soames, a proposition, rather than being like composed of things, is like a special psychological state that we share. When we're pointing in the same direction, we've got the same psychological state. And it's because that state is like pointing at the same thing that it means a certain way. And this means that they end up kind of disagreeing with Frege and saying that the meaning of a singular term, like the morning star or Venus or whatever, just is the thing, right? It's just that we have different psychological relationships to that thing. That's not meaning, that's just, you know, something else. Which is, again, kind of like frustrating. I'm getting very, very close to running out of time, so I've given you a kind of basic overview of the side of the analytic tradition of philosophy of language that I think is really problematic and dodgy. And so let me explain the side of light, which is nevertheless grown through a dialectic with the darkness of Sarah theoretical model. So basically, linguistic pragmatism. So people who, instead of saying, well, let's just, you know, pick sets of whatever the hell we like, and if there looks like there's some interesting containment relations, we can map it like that. You actually start methodologically, we have to look at the way in which language is used, and we have to find the syntactic structures we're interested in that use, and use them to articulate conceptual meaning. So if you think that tradition I was talking about comes out of Tarski, this tradition comes out of Gensler and proof theory. The attempt to understand how the pragmatics of reasoning form the sort of core of natural language semantics. And the important figures here are Fisellas, who I mentioned earlier, and Ramin. I mean, there's also kind of like sitting in between Michael Dummett, like I'll write Michael Dummett, like maybe someone. This Dummett is a Davidsonian. But he's a Davidsonian who was influenced by Gensler and proof theory and did some interesting stuff with that. And that's an influence on Ramin as well as Sellers. Sellers takes the Wittgensteinian challenge seriously. This idea that, look, meaning really is normative, and we've got to understand what kind of linguistic norms are constitutive of meaning. And Sellers' answer is, right, that's kind of reference, and I've thought about inference. So, what's interesting about Sellers is that, so put it this way, like, the meaning of a sentence in Sellers' picture is its inferential role, right? It's role within this game of giving and asking for reasons. As in, what it can be inferred from and what you can infer from it. And then you understand the meaning of words which compose it, like singular terms, predicates, and various different grammatical categories through verbs, transitive verbs, things like that, adjectives. as their contribution to this inferential law. What's interesting about Sellers' picture, beyond this kind of twist in the idea, is that not only does it enable you to see meaning as being constituted by a very particular kind of use, but it actually enables you to start differentiating meaning. So what Sellers actually gives us is a way of thinking about seeing the difference between empirical concepts and value concepts. And this is because he has this distinction between perception and action. So it's not just, we aren't just moving from sentences to sentences. The game isn't just playing around with tokens. There are things in the world that cause us to take up certain tokens, and there are certain tokens that cause us to do things in the world. There is a whole conceptual linguistic economy, right, of moving around with sentential tokens. And it turns out that if you understand the sort of the concepts as being rules for using these words and playing with these tokens, then empirical concepts are rules for or norms governing how to use these words in practices that are linked to perception, like science. Right? To understand an empirical concept, be it something as simple as a colour concept like blue, or something more complicated like electron, is to stand in some relationship to a kind of system for getting from perception to its use. So in the case of blue, it's usually just, I have the ability to go, oh, blue, right? I have a kind of a perceptual mechanism. But in the case of electron, I don't have a perceptual mechanism. But physics has a whole variety of perceptual mechanisms, as in experimental systems for dealing with these things. And it's those experimental systems that are bound up within that particular part of the conceptual economy, right, that we're part of. There's a sort of a division of linguistic and semantic labor. And similarly, you can understand value concepts as concepts that deal with the transits to action. So saying that an action is good is to say something like, well, Sarah's parables, you should probably do this. If you understand, like, there's a kind of paradox in the philosophy of value, which is, like, can you both understand that something is good and not do it? And this sort of semantic answer is, yeah, of course you can, but that means there's sort of something wrong with you in a certain sense. Like, that is to say that, like, the connection between your inferential and actual systems isn't quite working properly. Right, to properly understand the value concept is to have a certain relationship to action. And that works for all kinds of value concepts. Funny, virtuous, cleanly, you can more. Right. So what Sellers gives us is this different way of thinking about the relationship between words and the world. Rather than focusing on reference, which is the basis of most kind of model theoretical approaches. You just attach words to things and you say, well, these are in sets and we can work out relationships between the sets and that gives us meaning. You go, no, it's not as easy as that. We have to work out the concept, like the linguistic economy and the structures of this linguistic economy, which are like the conceptual structures. What Brand does is basically just to flesh this picture out. And there's a whole variety of things I can tell you about how this picture is fleshed out, but I am very much running out of time and we should get to questions. So I'm going to focus on the particular thing that that is interesting about Brand and the book. Oh, one point I forgot to mention it. So that whole thing I was saying about model theory is semantic false consciousness. It's a good example of set theory, like, making people fixate on a particular way of thinking about them. Right. Anyway, the thing that is interesting about running is okay, the ICA model, and you can't represent it. And this is where we get the navigation. Right? So, this ICA model is inference, substitution, and a format. So, you start out interested in inference. Instead of being interested in the truth conditions of a sentence, we're interested in its role within inferential space. The sentences it's related to in terms of what you can get from it and where it can go. Then you have to figure out how to work out what the words that compose that sentence are doing, what their role is in contributing to inferential role. And the basic way to do that is through substitution. So this is how random differentiates between singular terms and predicates. So very, very, very crudely, a singular term, like, is a dog, X is a dog. No, sorry, it's not a singular term, that's a predicate. So let's go with Fido and X is a dog, right? What differentiates these is their substitution relations. So with Fido, we can substitute that for, say, you know, my girlfriend calls him Rex instead. So if you say Rex is Fido, if you use the identity statement, what you're doing is encoding a legitimate substitution. So if I say Fido is, you know, a nervous dog, then I know Rex is Fido, then it's perfectly fine to say Rex is a nervous dog. That sounds incredibly trivial, but it's not completely. This is because the substitutions that that happen there are symmetric. Anything you can say about Fido, you can say about Rex, anything you can say about Rex, you can say about Fido, and you can go back and forth. In X is a dog, you can say, well, if X is a dog, then X is a mammal. So I can go, if Fido's a dog, therefore Fido's a mammal. But if I know Fido's a mammal, I can't go back. So the idea is basically what the rough structure that differentiates subjects and predicates is substitution relations and these kinds of symmetries and asymmetries. Anaphora. Anaphora is a linguistic structure to do with pronouns like it, he, she, things like that. And basically what that enables us to do is to pick up reference in conversation. So you can be talking about someone like, say, oh, yeah, I know him. Wasn't he the one who was drunk last Saturday? You know, or whatever. You know, we can form chains of reference through referring to what each other is referring to. You can say, well, I'm referring to what he's referring to, and he's referring to what he's... We can form these chains of reference which pick up significance. Right? It enables us to connect bits of information across those chains. This is quite important because you need this to make indexicals work and demonstratives. So in order to understand how saying, like, wow, this is a groovy laptop works, what this does is it begins a chain, right? Which you can then go, yeah, that, right? That, we're talking about that, right? And this is how we keep track of the reference of objects. There are some very interesting things about this, but I'm just going to... Well, one thing to say is that the word this doesn't make any sense unless we can do that. Right? If we couldn't track relations of anaphoric reference and anaphoric recurrence, and implicitly we couldn't use demonstrables. It would just be completely useless. So this we couldn't use demonstrables. Demonstrative deixis makes more sense without anaphoric. You need both.
Yeah, but it's not one without the other, because this is the computer only works with the gesture, whereas anaphora only like this giving text.
No, anaphora is a much more general structure. It's not just textual. And this is what I'm about to say. This is what's fascinating about random. I didn't quite realise is that actually what he's done here is to reconstitute sense reference distinctions. So what I was saying was that. So forgive the sort of story that I've been telling overall, a bit more structure. You have person Frege, both in vector quantifiers, and Frege has this sense reference distinction, but there's this tension in his work between it, because he tries to kind of collapse sense back in reference. And then what Carnap does is to properly do that, properly goes, no, right, to get the real sense, you've got intention now, you can specify that, purely functional, right?
Can I ask you a quick question about the anaphora again?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if it has to do, maybe it's a wrong interpretation, but what is this, is it always a normative thing? Or is there a possibility to create deviation within an anaphoric usage?
Oh, it's a normative thing, but normativity doesn't preclude deviation.
Okay.
So this is a crucial thing with regard to Kripke, and like if you've ever heard of rigid designators and this whole stuff to do with Kripke, one of the examples that always comes up is Madagascar. Mm-hmm. Like Madagascar originally wasn't what we think of as Madagascar. People went like pointed it out like Madagascar, and people misunderstood what they were talking about. But the word then got used to talk about Madagascar. But now we just use it to talk about the island of the coast of Africa. So it's perfect. Anaphoric chains split and diverge, and they're interesting. And they're particularly interesting because, as I'm going to say, that's an example of how anaphoric recurrence determines the meaning of proper names. It's not just it, he, and she, right? Things like that, or this. That structure of chaining constitutes the sense of terms. And you can see that in proper names, because in proper names, it's basically like someone goes, right, this is, call my laptop Prometheus, I think that's what it's called. This is Prometheus, right? And then from then on, whenever we're talking about Prometheus, if we understand its meaning in terms of how we sociologically trace the chain back to that initial meaning of that. And of course, you can get divergences, the chains can get snipped and go off in various different directions. But that's a way of thinking about how the meaning of names is constituted, the sense, right? And how the sense gets the reference. Now, generalize this, right? What? Okay. Right, that's a sense. Recurrence. And this is where we start to hit semiosis again. And this is where I think Frege and Peirce start to come back together. And we'll maybe talk about this. Right, occurrence substitution. So, what we have is two different kinds of equivalence relation. When I say the word Prometheus, right, that's an utterance, that's a use of a syntactic token, right? When you say the word Prometheus, that's a different use of that syntactic token, right? In what sense have we just expressed the same sound? Right? In what sense are we talking about the same sense? Right? Anaphoric chains are about relations of recurrence, where we go, those two, that's a recurrence of the same symbol. It's how we actually get lexical individuation, right? How we end up talking about word types rather than just instances, right? And more than just word types, but relations of synonymy, like brute synonymy, like those two things just mean the same thing, right? When you have these recurrence relations, you have the individuation of sense. And that works not just for proper names, but for predicates. So when we talk about gold, right, or when we talk about electrons, the example I was giving earlier, right, that we can use the same word because there is a certain kind of social tracking we're all engaged in. Tracking implicitly systems of reference back to essentially the bit of the social division of labour that links them back to their historical origin. Right? That keeps them fixed and keeps their use essentially the same. Substitution, when we have symmetric substitution relations, we have identity. When we have identity, we have objects, we have reference. Right? The set of things, the set of reference, is the set of equivalence classes of substitutable words. So you have basically equivalence classes of utterances, equivalence classes of words, and that gives you this distinction between sense and reference. And that's reconstructed purely within pragmatics. There's no need to talk about the reference relations between those things and the world. I'm going way over here. But that's basically a way of reconceiving sense of reference, and it's a basic way of enabling to pull Frege out of the kind of set theoretical madness of the analytic philosophy of language and reconnect it with something like Peircean semiotics and the category theoretic conception of thought in Peirce. But the way to understand this is that basically what sense is the domain of the variable. So you think what you have there is variables and what you have there is constants. Sense is the domain of quantificational variables. And essentially how this links up the category theory is that you remember what I was saying about Russell's type theory. Russell's type theory is his attempt to set theoretically delimit the whole domain of reference. And it's all about starting off with things that aren't functions and working your way through a functional hierarchy, blah, blah, blah. This way of thinking about things through Brandom inferentialism gives us a way of reconnecting with a category theoretical approach to variables, whereby we say that essentially what category theory talks about is the domain of pure sense in and of itself. Right? And it gives us a way of, instead of starting from things and trying to construct functions over things that expresses the universe of possible reference, we can actually kind of go sort of top down. We can imminently work through the variety of different possible sort of, so another way of looking at this is, I don't know if anybody's a programmer. But the crucial part of programming is variable typing. Keeping your variables sorted, making sure that you're not confusing lists and Boolean values. And this is an incredibly serious practical problem, right? But basically, it's not just a problem for computation in that sense. It's a problem of natural language. In natural language, we are always trying to implicitly type our variables. Right, that's why we've got different pronouns, he and she. Right, it's different. It's a very, very simple device for typing our variables, making sure that it can only vary over a certain kind of little range. And what you might call a conceptual scheme, our way of looking at the world, is basically made of implicitly variable typing. But seeing that we have these conceptual schemes, these implicit ways of referring, isn't to say that they're completely arbitrary. They're not. Because there is a fundamental structure of the variable, there is the invariant structure of sense itself. And that seems to be what we're getting at when we're talking about category theory. We're trying to come at the question of how, and to put this in other terms, right? We're trying to think about the very pure structure of navigation itself, right? That's what the kind of pure mathematical world is, working out the very structure of navigation, and then the conceptual scheme bit is working out, using it to actually work out ways to navigate the physical world we find ourselves in. So the question of reference and the question of representation is actually the question of the ways in which we socially structure how we conceptually navigate the world. This might be a bit abstract at this point.
I'm sure there are many.
Yeah, but let's stop there. And sorry, this is taking so long.
This isn't really a question. I'm just curious if, like, for those of us like me who have only really learned about language like Derrida, could you maybe say a little bit about how, like, the pragmatic or the school of like linguistic pragmatism would critique Derrida and like the idea of the trace and difference and kind of the inability to like reconstitute reference in some way? Like, how would you?
There's two basic criticisms. One is a quite technical one, which is just Derrida is still bound up within structuralism and the idea that the crucial dyad, the signifier, signified. You know how I was saying, like, the crucial canon insights, we start with the proposition, but they start with the terms, which is a much older way of thinking about language. And ironically enough, they go, aha, but no, we shouldn't think about like the direct relation of reference between the sign and the signifier. So they perform a similar move to what sort of inferentialists do, except they don't go, like, they go, well, what we need to do is understand relations between signifiers, right, rather than the relation between the relation between the sign and the signifier and the signified in terms of relations between the signifiers. And
so instead of like a dual or oppositional model in structuralism that is between what and what?
No. So the sort of supposed structural revolution is instead of thinking about a direct relation, reference relation between the signifier and the signifiers, the essence of meaning. You just call that the vertical relation. They go, well, all we want is to, we need to understand meaning in terms of the horizontal relation, the relation between the different signifiers. Right? And my point is,
the old metaphysical model between signifier and signified.
Isn't it more the
It's supposed to by going horizontal on the vertical.
Don't they kind of the way they get into it technically is this language synchronically and diachronically? In this.
We can go further into it, and to be honest, at a certain point, my understanding is But the Brandmorgan criticism is okay. Yeah, we're interested in relations between signifiers, but if you're just interested in that, you miss the important structure. And the important structure is relations between sentences, right? You need to understand the relationships between the signifiers, the expressions that constitute sentences, in terms of their contribution to the rules of sentences. So the actual structural, like, the interesting core of the structural sense of relations is inference. It's the game of giving and asking for reasons. But Derrida, particular, is, I mean, he calls this logocentrism, and he's hostile to it because iterability. You know, like, which.
Can I ask him to define structuralism just because?
Sorry. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I've got to just finish the second criticism. and then I'll come in. That's okay. So the second
reason. An entirely different interpretation of that question and the criticism.
Okay.
Yeah, because the.
Okay.
What?
Go ahead. Move. Yeah.
My question is because I'm worried about the relation between someone who I and when I'm looking on this model of language and linguistics, most of linguistics will be the view, and most of continental philosophy also not.
Yeah.
So if I now look on your model of language in terms of your model of freedom, I would say this model of language doesn't increase our freedom. It, when I go around them, I would say, no, it doesn't gives us more positive opportunities than the linguistic model does, or the model of language that comes from continental philosophy. In the qualitative sense, it excludes literature. In the actual sense, it doesn't account for things like manifestos and active language. What is left is that this model increases one thing in your model of freedom, which is irrationality of language. But if this is true, then your model of freedom becomes false, because it is not necessary for increasing our freedom.
I would
ask for how to relate these obviously very different interests in how to work on language and how made a model on language in terms of very specific interests in increasing rationality of language under the circumstances of maybe continental philosophy, literature,
Right. First of all, the whole point of my seminar this morning was that actually no rationality is necessary for freedom. Right. So from that perspective, I disagree with one of the things you said. Even if this was just about giving us a better conception of the pragmatics of reason, right, if that's all it did, right, it would therefore be an emancipatory form of self-consciousness. Right? Semantic self-consciousness, which is a limited kind of self-consciousness, but a useful one. Right? If that was all it was, right, it would still be emancipatory. But again, I also categorically reject the claim that continental philosophy of language is emancipatory, it's not. I consider it to be not exactly oppressive, but many of us have experienced it as oppressive. But because it is fundamentally about removing distinctions.
Yeah, but shouldn't we at one point start really to think philosophically instead of having this kind of bashing positions?
Oh, okay. I don't even know
what is the signifier? What is the signifier? Because I'm utterly confused now. Derrida we're so far away. Like, we talk about these huge things like rationalism and continental philosophy of language.
Okay.
I do not know where, what, how.
Okay.
What this.
I'll get more specific.
So no wonder that you are in disagreement with what are we talking about?
Okay. Well, let me just say my irritation with certain kinds of thought about language is that it thinks that you said on the one hand, continental philosophy of language and you have linguistics. I'm a lot less hostile than linguistics because it's interested in specifics. It's interested in really trying to understand the structures of issue. And in that sense, the original tradition of structuralism was exactly about that. But what gets called post-structuralism, what Derrida represents more than anything else, is this kind of this gesture of going, oh well, because there's non-literal language as well as literal language, you can't therefore prioritise the structure of literal discourse, provide analysis of its specific structures, and then try and explain how non-literal language diverges from it. It says because, like, there's a fuzzy border there, right? Ultimately, there can't be any specificity, there can't be any detail, and I think that gesture is non-emancipatory. It's counter-emancipation because emancipation doesn't understand it. Like, we want more understanding of how language works. So if you're interested in power relations, how power relations are manifest within language, so particularly things like shibboleths, jargon, things like this, you need to understand the core semantic structures through which the power relations function. And I've had people tell me, I can't do semantics because, like, there's always power. Like, power will always corrupt any sort of universalist attempt to describe the structure of language, and that just seems, like, absolutely topsy-turvy. If you want to understand power, you have to understand the structures through which it's being exercised. Now, the specific question about, like, what are signs, what are signifiers, and I agree, this is why I was trying to sort of gesture towards semiosis. I recognise there's a whole Persian tradition that I'm trying to see how the Phrygian tradition maps with it. And so what Andrew's interested in with regard to deixis is what I'm interested in with regard to anaphora. But anaphora in the sense of...
It's part of deixis.
Hmm?
Yeah,
not quite as limited as the other way around, which is...
There seems to be a very specific Brandeian definition of anaphora. So from theory of deixis, which is comes from Weber, anaphora has a very specific meaning in deixis. Deixis tries to reformulate the relation between syntax and pragmatics. They are very good suggestions to resolve analytical philosophy of language within the semiotic project, which I have, for instance, play, so that this is a sort of tradition of increasing rational, functional interests in language. But I, for instance, also doubt that it is capable of any semantic self-consciousness, which literature can be blamed for poetics and linguistics.
If you don't think that the ability to articulate relations between like technical concepts in terms of how their inferential roles work is a kind of self-consciousness. I don't want to say that there's no self-consciousness from the side of poetics and from the expanded use of language and the expanded sense of pragmatics. I'm trying to. That's, I haven't talked about that, but that's not to say that I think it's impossible.
No, but I mean, it's a very important, like, methodological, like, question, you know, like, and it's important to get over the polemics, you know, because if I say, oh, I made a rationalist to say, like, I'm going to kill my cat because it's just sentient, you know, like, that's like, so what? I'm going to ask an idiot. Of course, they're idiots, not religions, you know, but like,
that's not good.
So the point is, like, how, like, what do you mean when you say logic, innovation, reason, semantic, self-consciousness? You know, and you have to understand, like, why is this focus on logic and semantics?
My
know, for example, like, syntax and gateways. I mean, you know, it's important in order to just understand
each other,
it's important to what's the reason why Brandon takes out a term that was invented by Bühler, completely changes its meaning,
what and is?
It takes it not for, like, what's prior, what comes after, and how does that relate to his completely interesting idea that, or his focus on semantics instead of, like, grammar, for example. I mean, that's why it gets interesting. That would, my question be, like, what does it mean to say that logical innovation produces semantic self-consciousness?
Okay, well, again, like...
And why is it not, like, a linguist who would say, or grammarians would say that it's syntactical This is something that is syntactical self-consciousness, you know, via recursion or so. I mean, that's, these are interesting questions and not like whether they're idioms or ideas.
True. Sorry. Well, we can talk about those questions. I got a question about Derrida and why happened.
Yeah, but then we would if we really talk about Derrida, then the question is like, what does he understand by signifier? Why does he keep reference out? And what has been the tradition before? And why do analytical philosophers remain as well in an oppositional logic? You know, and don't get to the first one like dramatic logic. But then you know, like, then we would have to discuss this. You know.
Well, we can talk expanding here, but like, I don't know enough about Burns to be able to describe the, where I see the triad fitting in my picture. I could sketch it, but I can't. That's why I'm hoping that we can kind of get a bit of dialogue tomorrow. But I can tell you about the Rangoli picture and put it forward.
It seems like we're sort of spinning circles here between you and Pete. That Pete is focusing on those categories in the production of linguistic sense and reference that are in some sense instrumental to understanding reason and the practice of giving and asking for reasons is one thing. I don't think Peter anymore said that this is all that language does or that language has no poetic dimension. The most you could challenge him on, I think, at this point is that he seems to be presenting an account of rationality that seems to be at least relatively independent of poesis and like, the more poetic manipulations of language. That's a point you might be able to challenge there, but I think you need a much clearer focus on saying, what about poetics? What about, Strauss's accounts of poetics and so on? It's a very blunt, intimate question. On the other hand, you seem to be asking people for reasons and would be unsatisfied if he responded with sort of to a string of signifier that you could attract a certain musicality in it, which had did not seem to be giving a reason. I mean, you accused multiple times here of having of just making a statement instead of producing an argument. So I mean, you are acknowledging that there is some sort of practice of asking and giving for reasons that's at least if not wholly relatively independent. At least on a very long tether from poetic and rhetorical implications. And maybe it would be worth just considering these. We have this massively complex system that we call language, which performs a myriad of social functions. If we maybe isolate which functions we're interested in understanding, then we can come up with something like a nice scheme for trying to break down, at least in some coarse way, how that happens. If you're asking, what about this and that dimension? Well, are these dimensions essential for understanding reasoning? Maybe, but then an argument has to be provided for that. If you can't say, well, what about them? It's true that he said nothing to account for, like symbolic texture, musical dimension of language, everything is important in poetry. You couldn't generate a really good theory of poetics out of this. I mean, logic has a role in poetry, but a minor. So
I have a certain kind of plan. And this is what I was. I set as a reading for this particular session a partial draft of a paper in which I'm attempting to expand the inferentialist account of philosophy of language into a general account of communication. So basically, what I've been talking so far about today is representation. And so when I was talking about the question of variable typing, implicit conceptual schemes, and that what is navigation, that is representation. Representation is navigation, attempting to figure out how we refer to the world and how we can navigate with each other within the world through representing, through using words. However, the use of words, language, is more than representation. There's more to language than representation. That's key. A lot of what goes on in language, however, although it is not representative, is in many ways parasitic upon representation. And that's the logocentric claim. The logocentric claim is, yes, reason is at the heart of language, but that isn't to say it's all language. It's just, it gives, if you have a good account of linguistic rationalism, you can get some additional things out of it. So here is what I've been trying to work towards. It's not complete. But basically, I've got an account of communication as breaking down in roughly three dimensions: implication, connotation, and negotiation. So implication is what I've talked about so far. It is inference. So what I've been trying to say is, we understand the representational function of language in terms of the pragmatics of the game, in the asking for reasons, and this has a kind of substitutional and anaphoric infrastructure. Connotation is a necessary consequence of having such an infrastructure, right? And this is because basically determining the meaning or the sense of the contribution of words within context is actually incredibly difficult. We do it mostly implicitly. We are very good at doing it, but explaining precisely what we do in doing it is hard. So it's important to recognize that words can have, and in an important sense, the same words can have a sort of variety of meaning. And the way I prefer to say this is to say that words can have multiple sets of connotations that are sociologically connected with one another. And in using them, we tend to only activate, we try actively to activate only a certain set of those connotations. Which is to say, we try and limit connotation into implication. So a way of thinking about this is to think about synonymy. So the example I always use here is the word queer, which is, in a certain sense, synonymous with the word strange. Right? There's a certain context in which it is intersubstitutable with the word strange. And there are other contexts in which it's definitely not intersubstitutable with the word strange. And that's to say that its connotations exceed that particular set of implications, right? And it's, but the thing is, to understand connotations is to understand them as precisely the extra range of possible sets of implications, right? So, like, the inferentialist conception of meaning in terms of inference gives you an account of representation, but it also gives you an account of, like, the halo of representation, right? The additional layers of informational content that come along with the sort of representational infrastructure of the words you're using. And one way of describing poetry would be as a type of tactics of connotation. You talk about wax.
Yeah, poetic, which is something different.
Okay.
But I guess the problem that we have other.
I mean, the poetry was mentioned, to be fair. Like.
Yeah. I mentioned it maybe as the same poets, but I mean, both poets and poetry are related. I mean, talking about similar devices.
My question was almost purely a clarificatory one.
Okay,
I was going to ask right at the beginning. But, so the picture that you lay out, this picture where, in a sense, the primary deviation that Brandon would take with someone like, say, Prithi, is this ICA model, in a way. And so you break this down into implication, what was the second connotation?
Substitution.
Inference.
Substitution.
Sorry, it's an ISA model, not an ICA
yeah,
model.
That's why I don't
why. I don't know why IOC, that's kind
right,
of
so
wrong.
ISA model. And then you
substituted it.
Yeah.
So you give these examples where you have for I, you have like X as a dog, X as a mammal, and so on.
Yeah.
This is not something that's uniquely Brandonian, right? I mean, this would be equally true for Crypto, as far as I can understand it.
It's different. Like,
but what I'm trying to get to is that, so far as I would have assumed based on the picture that you laid out, it seems that both implication and substitution could equally be mapped within a novel theory, right? It's anaphoria that's the really specific difference, which then you cash out in terms of this chain of reference kind of thing, that's what's specific about it. But then, again, I struggle to understand specifically why this would be different from, say, the causal theory of reference, unless it's simply that the reference shifts through its employment.
The important thing is it captures all that stuff. It captures everything that can be done with cryptic and model theory, and everything that can be done with the causal theory reference. Right? But it does it in a way without mechanism. It does it just by saying, so like, one of the things about Frege's theory of sense is he's a Platonist. He thinks senses are these like platonic entities that we can all access, right, in a certain sense. Whereas this is a purely like intersubjective account of sense. Sense is a kind of just normative thing, as a kind of communal way of navigating which way we're inferentially putting it.
So then is the claim that what Brandon hashes out is uniquely utile? Is that you can do the same thing you can do with model theory, but you don't have to integrate with methods? Because that seems like a completely different claim.
No. That's just the starting point. You need to be able to say that. You need to be able to say, look, we can do everything you can do, and we can do it without your weird methods. But from that point on, you can then articulate some additional and more interesting developments. So to tie in some of this stuff regarding broader uses of language. Right. One of the interesting things is, so identity. In Brandon's account, the identity locution basically just makes explicit this. Right. So it's what he calls an instant substitution license. Right. You can say, look, wherever the word fiber is used, you can substitute the word X. However, there are some fundamental limitations on those kinds of substitution licenses. So the classic example is the Phrygian. So if I say, Clark Kent, what a coward. What an absolute coward. Superman, he's just absolutely fantastic. He's so brave. Right, that seems to be kind of like contradictory, right? You could say of Pete that Pete thinks that Clark Kent is coward, right? But it would seem that because of the substitution license, Clark Kent is Superman, right, is Superman, you could then say, oh, Pete thinks Superman's a coward, but I don't think Superman's a coward, I think Superman is fantastic, right? But it's just that I don't know that Superman is Clark Kent, right? So that's what you call an intentional context in which identity breaks down. But the thing is that actually once you start thinking in these terms, once you stop seeing identity in metaphysical terms and see it as a thing we're doing with words, you can describe more interesting identity operators which have further limited contextual functions. So you can talk about quasi-identity operators, and this is a really, really good way of thinking about how analogy works. So you can say, like, what was your fantastic analogy about set theory in Superman?
Oh yeah, that's right. So it's taken off of the first part was off of Frank Miller there, Batman fights Superman, right? And Batman wins every time, right? Even though he has no superpowers at all. And his criticism of Superman, I think in one of the two Frank Miller and Batman, it's a big one, was that he says, the problem with you Superman is that you've always been too powerful to be smart. And so this is, you can do anything, so you never had to figure out how to do anything. Right,
in this analogy, Superman is set theory, right? Superman is model theory, right? But of course, when I say Superman is model theory, I am not saying model theory goes around with its underpants on the outside. That doesn't make any sense, right? So there's some fundamental limitations upon substitution there, right? So what you're saying is that once you start thinking about sense and substitution in these terms, you can start actually providing a fairly formal account of what we're doing in making analogy. And that actually is in one way a making explicit metaphor, but a termination metaphor. Because in metaphor, you just let the kind of connotations loose. You kind of let people select them for themselves. And then when someone takes the metaphor in a wrong direction, you go, no, in this case, right, the analogy is Superman is model theory. And then you can start going even further and explaining, well, these are the sort of substitutional relations I'm allowing, and these are the ones I'm not. Like, and this is precisely the kind of the thing which, where, like, Zalamir is very interesting when describing how category theory actually provides a certain kind of formalization of metaphor and analogy. And this is precisely what I'm talking about from the linguistic side, I think. If you think category theory is the domain of sense, and you think, well, what it's doing is talking about morphisms between utterances, and then morphisms between chains of utterances, you can start to describe how analogies and metaphors work on the back of a sort of base inferential structure.
Well, one interesting example of how set theoretical, I mean, more broadly, transcendent referential account of meaning and of account of meaning as a foundation of logic, the way this actually forecloses certain poetic operations that are going to be recapture or at least reapproach through logic in terms of this pragmatic approach. So if you look back at Boole, it's like the first clear full formalization talk. And you look at how Boole sort of introduces and justifies the various rules and principles there. And one of them is just what he's called the fundamental law of thought. This is the one that results in restricting logic to just the values of 0 and 1. And the reason for this is that 0 and 1 are the two values that are idempotent under qualification, which in logic, in his logic, translates into conjunction or combination. This means that they're the only two values for which x times x equals x. Or in logic terms, x and x is equivalent to x. And what this does, and even sort of most poetry is embarrassing here, is that the reason why there is no rational content in, say, poetic repetition, for emphasis, it was a stormy, stormy night, or something like that, is that the repetition of stormy adds nothing to the content. So that we have this notion of cognitive content, which is then independent from all this. With Dreyse's syntactic repetition from reversal of terms order of the order of terms, which is how he justifies commutativity. And so you see here is because he begins with this positively transcendent reference tree to the terms, this is the foundation for meaning. He excludes from logic right off the bat factors like repetition, like syntactical space and time. Everything is sort of quotiented out in this reference to the transcendent thing. And this is the vision of logic that later in a sort of fermenting into the Tarski and semantics as the church. And you already see it there in Boole. It is beautifully expressed because he does invoke the contrast between logic and poetics. And this is wildly different. Poetics is cognitively null because it sort of moves within the space opened up by these laws. Its differences make no logical difference. And so if you want to ask how logic can approach poetics, then you do need to challenge this this image of thought within logic within which logic is couched. So that's my personal favorite example. So it's just so nice and clear. It's in Boole's Laws of Thought, which is a beautiful text.
But there was really missing something. I'm really like this whole approach towards reason and against logic when it comes to poetics. So I should think the logic of language is sort of like very different. It's not the semantic level, but like on the grammatical level. And I didn't hear anything about it.
Syntax as necessitated by a sort of pragmatic constraint. Syntax is sort of abstract generalities of grammar.
That syntax is only one part of grammar, one is morphology. But what I wanted to say is that one basic problem that
I think we have, we come from different traditions.
I
come
from different tradition too.
Yeah, yeah. That's why we have to define do we talk about do we talk about grammar, do we talk about syntax, do we talk about deixis, which maybe we should try to
from comedy, from grammar, one problem with a representational view of language would be that it is too much concerned with things and words and their equation. So it operates only on a very, very tiny level, which is lexicology. And the substitution question for linguists would be served in a lexicon. So that what you would get is maybe a lexicological project in the Foucauldian sense, but
that's model theories. That's what I want to begin.
So, and there it ends. If you try to find or if you locate the rationality of language not on the representational level, not on the lexicological level, not tied to things, not tied to words, so words would be the least important category in language for grammarian. They are surface structure, manifest, maybe something that via theory of representation ties language and word. But in a grammarian, you would rather would say that language, via its rationality of grammar, is a locator. So what it does is not equating things and words via lexical semantics, but it would locate, or it would help you navigate in, for instance, making objects and things of relational perceptions. For that, it would locate you in space, time, subject. This is what theory of dance does. And poetry would be part of a linguistic self-consciousness as an innovation tool, as a recursive tool. And this also
is it always a tool, or can it be something that isn't a tool at all?
It can. It goes beyond. There's a. One would say it's the freedom dimension. Location. This would be a dimension of representation. I mean, what if I'm just representing things like the box, or giving like states of affairs and locating the speaker and
the emphasis of the lexicology.
With locating in the sense local, global relation. So it's relational. You think of all the global relations. You think of time.
In this case, relations.
Boxes maybe come much later.
I don't say boxes. I say propositions. Like in this. I mean, if I was going to just try to, say situate us within like a broader context, I would do that through the medium of sentences that would seem to be, that would have a content that could be interrogated, that could be challenged, that would have to be figured out reasons for or fail to. It seems that, I mean, and there's going to be shades of this activity that we haven't talked with here yet, of course. I mean, we've not that, but I guess I'm not sure what you think this account is missing. I don't think it's complete, it's not, but it's certainly not reducing everything to the word, lexicology, into noun reference. I mean, I think that was the first thing that you distance yourself from.
It's literally like the enemy is that model theoretic lexicology. Like, the whole point of going to inference or reference is to avoid that lexicological view of language. It's to try and reconstruct meaning out of the movements of the sign, the uses of... it's just that we focus on sentences as primary. So one way of thinking about this is to say that... Okay, so in a very general kind of structure...
How do you explain?
Right, what I've been talking about with sentence reference, we've got this sort of like... we've got these utterances, and then we've got sort of morphisms between utterances, and then this gives us our level at which we're talking about sentences. And then at this, you've got morphisms between sentences, and that gives your level at which you're talking about propositions. And the idea is simply that we all think the interesting structure is in the transformation of words into words, or the morphisms between words, the relations. That's the basic kind of structuralist insight in which we can all kind of agree roughly, I think. What my position basically advocates, and in the end, I say this is what Lucentrism, and what this consists in is simply saying, look, the core structural morphisms we should be interested in are the sentential morphisms. And we understand how the other morphisms between words relatable. And it's not to say that those are the, like, that there are other morphisms going on. There's a whole kind of interesting set of relations between symbols and whatnot. And but if you want to actually to really understand like the whole structure of the practice, the representational dimension is the heart, and that dimension is sentential, and the embedding of the sentential within perception and action. So the other thing I'm saying the core navigational role of language is representation. The title of this particular seminar is Representation as Navigation. I think. Or navigation as representation. One of the two. Right? It's about the linguistic structure through which we conceptually navigate, or the linguistic machinery through which we conceptually navigate reality. But it turns out that there's a whole lot more going on with that structure. It's not just inference, it's not just this stuff. But the claim is this is the core, and that by starting with this core you could work your way out. And that's what I'm trying to do with this implication, connotation, negotiation. You can start here and you can develop a much wider conception of communication, and you can include into that things like analogy and metaphor, and you can see how the sort of formalisms which enable you to get purchase upon representation give you purchase upon other things. Use a pragmatic approach to capture what classical analytic philosophy of language through model theory can already do, and then on that basis to do what it can't do. It's about moving beyond. I think there's an important sense in which this tradition has to be grappled with, because they have spent a long time thinking about the structure of representation, and they've got some insights that you have to be able to recreate in a pragmatic framework if you want to.
I think there are questions over there.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, just wanting to kind of circle back around and articulate another view of what I take Ankit to be raising as a kind of issue that I also kind of am sympathetic to. What seems to me to be happening is there's been a kind of conjunction of a sort of category theory based theory of, like, general theory of epistemology or artificial general intelligence, which is being sort of like applied in different domains, but under the auspices of a much more general claim as to what's intended, what's the intended sort of fruit of this practice, of this application, this kind of synthesis. What seems to be maybe at issue in some of the comments that seems to be having difficulty reaching across some translational barriers is the fact that in making claims related to the specific application, there's sort of several levels, ironically, I think, of argument which are getting conflated, which have to do with, on the one hand, you know, how does category theory work as a general epistemological theory? I think that itself is actually super interesting and debatable, but obviously requires some highly specialized training to really grapple with it seriously. So in that sense, like, given that this seminar is comprised of an audience and a set of participants with very widely divergent backgrounds and interests, obviously, you know, a practical competency with category theory is not a requirement.
No, I agree.
Now, so that means that we have to figure out ways of making the claims that are being advanced towards the general intents that are under the auspices of which the seminar is organized, accessible for people from varying backgrounds. So there has to be the constitution, in some sense, the object of what we're trying to do is to constitute a generally accessible platform on which to be able to have a discussion that would be informed by several different backgrounds. I won't be too much longer. Excuse me. The problem, if we don't manage to do that, is that there becomes a kind of issue of like a real issue of alienation around either having to accept the word of someone who claims the right to represent a tradition that's not accessible. You know what I mean? When the implications that are being drawn are not satisfactory from other perspectives. So this is an interesting.
Okay, can I explain what I'm doing? Can I reframe?
Well, can I offer just one more sort of additional clause? What I take you to be doing, and not just you, but I think this is a project that's shared among you and other people who have a set of shared interests and backgrounds that you consider to be complementary with one another in a certain productive sense, is to arrive at not only, like, what I hear being advanced as a claim from your camp is that you're arriving at not only a sufficient explanation of language, or let's say epistemology in its relation to practical freedom, emancipation as navigation, but a necessary one. So you're saying that this is not only a sufficient account of this conjunction, but a necessary. You have to go.
No, I'm saying it's a necessary, but not sufficient. It's not sufficient. It's necessary. Only necessary.
Well, so from the sort of, I would say, like, more humanities-based perspective, I mean, in a way, what your position assumes is that a necessary condition doesn't need to satisfy a kind of sufficient condition, because the necessary must be exclusive. The necessary way to understand this must be exclusive.
I find this incredibly frustrating because the repeated gesture seems to be, you're not talking about what I'm interested in, therefore you can't.
Therefore
this thing has been excluded.
The problem is that there are traditions in which there can be, like, for linguistics is an excellent example, there's several sort of
I know, and I've tried my best to, like, do the, like, within the space of 3 hours, I have done my absolute best to give a complete presentation of the analytic philosophy of language as there is, and is situated in relation to the history of thinking about language, and I signposted as best as I could that here are the things that I'm not talking about.
To totalize your account, that is problematic.
But I haven't totalized. I haven't said this is all that can be said.
what you have said is, I don't know much about this tradition at, like, let's say.
So am I supposed to shut up?
Is why it's not relevant. To
what is exactly the alternative? I mean, you can start giving your alternative to Keith, and Pete can,
What am I excluding other than not talking about traditions I am not completely familiar with?
Well, no, exactly. What is the alternative? What are you proposing as a set of alternatives that can be worked on?
I think the question is the proposal, in a way, like, drawing. We are all drawing a lot on Zelamantic as a reference, in a way. And one of the things that comes up is, for example, gluing. And, like, Peirce himself and Zalamea also talk about transits between disciplines. So I think what then what would follow from that would be like, for example, what Anke is saying is like, what do we do with that? Precisely considering that if you don't have that much knowledge of that, but she does have knowledge of something else, mm-hmm. then we have to find, I think, a precise way of like articulating that transit positively. Like, and that maybe that would be a thing.
I mean,
it's not so much about thinking anything is excluded anywhere. You know, it's not about exclusion. The thing is, I have an opinion where the capacity for navigation and reason in languages, I think it's somewhere else. So as soon as I say that, you know, I don't want to hear that, like, I don't share the kind of rationalist approach or so. This is like thinking in boxes and like enemies, and so it would be good to break down and focus on or find like really concrete, like linguistic questions.
But that's not a concrete example. Maybe name a particular function that you don't think this model can recover, he can try and give a speech of that function, and he can succeed or fail.
It's
no, but it's
you said manifestos, for example. Manifestos?
Can I respond?
Yeah, about manifestos. It's like, where is the I mean, we don't
do that.
I think there's one very general point.
It's a small time thing. I asked like the logical.
Logical
innovations abuses semantic subconsciousness, and I said like, well, maybe it's a grammatical innovation that produces different forms of subconsciousness.
Logical innovation is grammatical innovation.
What?
It's a subspecies of grammatical innovation.
Yeah, but then, you know, we would have to, like, really just check with Brandon. I mean, I got a question.
I'm not going to be like,
two concrete answers, right? One concrete point. Okay. Grammar. Where does grammar sit in this position? The example I gave for the distinction between subject and predicates in terms of different forms of substitution relation. Right, that's the fundamental grammatical distinction within this kind of schema, but it's not the only one. Brandon, if you look at chapter 6 of Making Explicit, which is, I apologise, the worst chapter, it's awful, but it has at the end, it has this appendix on providing something like a transformational grammar within substitution in substitutional inferentialist terms. So he's particularly interested in being able to recuperate things like the difference between transitive and intransitive verbs in terms of substitutional structures and things like that. So it's not that this is opposed to grammar. There is a position for grammar here. There's some translation problems, and hopefully we'll get to work through it. But there is a point of connection. The other point of connection there is if we're interested in gluing, just to re-describe what the whole seminar is about, right? The whole seminar, so think of it this way. What I've said in the first seminar was there's an important sense in which to be free requires having certain specific rational capacities, and these rational capacities involve an ability to representationally navigate the world. This, in this seminar, was an attempt to articulate schematically and in relation to a certain tradition of thinking about representation what these representational capacities must consist in. Now, another way of looking at that in terms of traditions and transits, and this is something that maybe I didn't emphasize it, is that I see there being this crucial moment in Frege at which the analytic philosophy of language and the tradition of thinking about representation begins, right? And that moment is, as it were, bound into a certain kind of somatic false consciousness by its dependence upon category theoretic and functional category theoretic approaches to proof conditions, right? And that what I'm trying to say is this sort of pragmatic inferentialist approach within the philosophy of language that comes out of that tradition but rejects that semantic self-consciousness is in a certain sense an attempt to recoup Frege, to recoup one side of Frege from the other, to if Carnap resolves the tension between sense and reference in the favour of reference to try and solve the tension between sense and reference in the direction of sense. And one way of describing that is to say to create transit between Frege and thus. To create a transit between... So this, I wasn't... Whenever I'm talking about category theory here, at no point is there any need to understand category theory to explain the actual semantic machinery here. I would like to introduce some category theory, but I can't because I'm not a specialist. What I can say is why the category theoretical machinery which is appropriate to person's conception of language is also appropriate to this. Because there is a transit between the Persian and the Phrygian tradition in the pragmatic reconstitution of sense. So I'm just trying to sort of say, well, actually, you know what? Phrygian philosophy of language is something to recoup. It's something that makes sense from within the sort of epistemological position or framework being developed out of the sort of Zalamean category theoretical approach. It's not something that requires that to understand it. In fact, in certain circumstances, it enables understanding because, like the example I gave yesterday about smaller and taller, that's a very good example of how you see how concepts can't be encapsulated by sets. Right? You need to understand the relationships in order to understand what meaning is doing there. And what that suggests is a certain inadequacy within set theory that a different formalism needs to pick up, a different way of thinking about the relations between the words. So it's a point towards, a transit towards category theory, not something that presupposes it. It's a way of making the same points about meaning and conceptual understanding from within a certain tradition of thinking about representation. It's...
One interesting question here, I was reading just your text again, and there's a moment here where you touch on something that sounds like explicitly addressing something that sounds like Phrygian semantics. And so that might be a nice point of convergence. And what you say about it in this text is that, quote, the most general semantics is continuously differentiated and concretized by syntactic structures. Summing up, Elizabeth Leese writes that, quote, that a proposition with the help of grammar produces a proper name from a generic concept. And this is precisely what Frege took a proposition to do as well, the proper name, the referent of which would either be the true or the false. So maybe you could say something about what you take the referent of this proper name to be. You see propositions as names, as opposed to something that, if the sense is to be determined within its naming function, if this reference is to be determined within its naming function, as opposed to it, say its role in a practice of giving us for reasons, for example, then maybe that could be the point where you could address the proposal reference, since he has spoken with the Frege approach. And then you can go on and say the referential structure of meaning is thus differentiated and approximates the relationships that objects obtain from one another. And this sounds very close to Russell. So that's not exactly what Russell says. So it seems that you're not adopting sort of classical Fregean Russellian approach to semantics. So maybe you aren't too far from training in carbon. Is that fair enough, representative?
This is the part you wrote is part of an explanation of sense making and one could say referent creating or creating things by means of language. So this is the middle part of the process, which is circular and consists of denotation, symbolization, and pointing back to a different point of origin in the world, which is not necessarily thing-related. But of course, Frege and analytic philosophy of language has a position in and in kind of language, but it would not put representation on its core. It would say it's one element in a circular structure. And so in such a linguistic approach to language that navigates through the opportunities in language to expand our capacity of sense-making, having access to the world, acting via group representation would have a position, but not the position of the four.
Well, you take the representation here, that this is what Peter is trying to reduce to sort of an ongoing process, as you say, dialogue, communication, for instance. This dialogical reasoning, for instance. Even if it's just implicit within a single reasoner's activity. And so this sort of Frakian and Russellian account of reference we take to be parasitic on a more attractive activity of dialogue. He is also saying this. If this is what you mean by representation, he is trying to explain that away and not take that to be the core. What he's more broadly calling representation then is this it is this practice as a whole that sustains this this production of terms that function as proper names, that sort of allows non-sentential objects to be picked out as reference. None of this is primary, and this is where he's trying to depart from Russell and Frege. Maybe you were trying to depart from Russell and Frege in a similar or different way, but you're both taking this as something that needs to be explained, not something that does be explained. And in this respect, you are a common ground, at least in this paragraph, if you take this as something that has to be explained away. That it's not itself a sufficient account of giving reasons, producing a discursive scene, locating yourself in a state of affairs or situation. This can be explained in terms of direct reference.
If I can expand on that, because the dialogical point is really important, and it's something I didn't really get to. Brandon's account of representation, I said there's a few things that are really important on it. I only really got to explain the ICA, that ISA model. Why the hell do I call it ICA? And the sense reference distinction. But I didn't really explain the account of representation. Basically, what Brandon does at the end of making explicit is he gives an account of what he calls Dorian and Dictal representation of all that. So all of that. And about words like this. He sees these as logical vocabulary, which is unusual. And the account basically shows how we navigate between one another's inferential perspectives. Because for Brandon, all of us are what he calls theontic scorekeepers. We're all keeping track of the inferential relations, our own commitments and the inferential relations between those commitments. And these perspectives are diverging. And this means that communication can't be seen as exchange, can't be seen as the simply giving of a prepackaged content to another. It has to be seen as a kind of dialogical navigation of one another. And sometimes this dialogical sometimes it's just shut the door, and that's incredibly straightforward. And sometimes it's a seminar like this where navigating between different histories, different theoretical languages, navigating between different conceptions of synonymy and connotation is incredibly hard. But the core of this process of perspectival navigation is the ability to say that, to stipulate that we're talking about the same thing. It's the ability to go. So the example he gives is in a courtroom. The defence lawyer, so the prosecution might say, aha, but the defence lawyer has claimed of a total liar that he is a trustworthy expert, that his testimony is trustworthy. And of course, this gets back to the intentional context to which I referred before. Of course, the defence lawyer would not endorse that description of his beliefs. He would not, If he actually believed that a total liar was a trustworthy witness, he'd be completely self-contradictory beliefs. It'd be obviously wrong, right? But in the of there, he believes of a total liar. What the one side is able to do is to differentiate between what he's committed to and what the other person he's in dialogue is committed to, in such a way that they fix that they're talking about the same object. Like, they fix that they're talking about the same object even as they disagree about it. But because the important thing about objects is that, and the important thing about reference is it's required in order to have disagreement. This is basically Hegelian ideas. We need to be able to fix what we're talking about, be it a concrete object or person, or be it truth justice in the American way. You know, we need to be able to fix what it is we're talking about in order to have potential disagreements about it. And so that fixing operation is the core of dialogical navigation. And there's more operations than this. There's more things we do to navigate one another's perspectives, and there's more logical vocabulary that corresponds to it. So, for instance, in fact, very, very classically, the language of meaning, saying that, well, this word means this, or that person meant this by that, right? Redescribing something in different terms is a navigational gesture whereby we try and reorient us or work out how our inferential perspectives are divergent or convergent. There's also, you might want to give the example of epistemic morals, which are moral logical operators like certainly. Like, yeah, it's certain that, or it's uncertain that. And this is useful, because I was talking about this, these epistemic, semantic, and moral dimensions. So necessary and possible, language here, means does not mean the language here. In epistemic discourse, we have a completely different kind of variation, where the variation is between our perspectives, rather than something that we're thinking in the world. So, for example, the thing which cuts across here is, the Goldbach conjecture. Famous conjecture in mathematics, unproven. There's a sense in which you want to say the Goldbach conjecture is possible, that might be true, right? But there's another sense in which, if it is true, then it's necessarily true. And if it's false, then it's necessarily false. Right, so how can it be both in a certain sense possible and in another sense necessary? Well, it's because the sense in which it's possible is epistemic. It's relativized to our current knowledge. As far as we know, right, from within the particular discursive space we're operating within, it might be true or it might not. We can't connect it up. And so saying things like I'm certain about it or I might are ways of sort of delimiting the structure of debate we're in.
Sorry to ask you this, really.
Go for it.
Is Brandon then super valuationist in this sense?
No, this is me. This is not Brandon. This is me riffing on Brandon. Brandon only has one real account. Like, the whole thing is that we need to give an account of these representational practices, and these practices are the practices through which we collectively navigate a world, which means not just the way in which we reference things, but the way in which we dialogically navigate one another's points of view. Brandon basically says these practices are there, but he only really has an account of one aspect of it. And what I'm sort of trying to gesture at is how actually there's a lot more complicated stuff there, and there's interesting things. But this is the kind of end point that I was trying to get to in saying that representation is navigation. Representation is this kind of inferential navigation of our different inferential perspectives as situated within practical context, which is to say, as situated as mechanisms for taking input from the world and producing sentences and outputting into the world. Right? The Salazian picture I gave this morning gives you the situation within context. Instead of thinking about the relation between words and world as a direct one, the lexical relationship is like, well, this word just refers, it just has stands in relation to this. We think about the connection as being constituted through this complex inferential economy that is, in a certain sense, a practical economy situated within reasoning systems within the world that are exchanging tokens between them. Does that make sense? Sorry. Does anybody else have any?
I'm going to mumble a bit. I'm starting with a point, a few points there that I thought were very poignant, I guess, in a sense that it made you jump, because and I'm inferring here that there was a sense, you're using a certain, if you like, navigational aesthetics, I would say, that produce a certain situation, a certain sense of estrangement that came up, and there was a sense of it rather than some sort of I can point at this or that, because the whole thing is kind of how you navigate. And even the term navigation, you had to qualify. It's very interesting. I'm saying it's really very interesting. You had to qualify it as a dialogical navigation. Whereas for me, well, you don't want to dialogically navigate. Well, why do I need to create this category? I can just negotiate. Yeah. You can now. If there was a negotiational aesthetics going around. Yeah, which means basically that we all kind of discuss a certain issue and negotiate with one another, there wouldn't be that sense of alienation, if you like, the kind of estrangement that came up. And I thought that it was quite poignant, because there is, again, going for yesterday's discussion, the kind of, we was talking about the kind of emergence, that like there's something that intends something and then something else comes out. That was exactly that. you wanted to, I have my own meaning, this is what I'm trying to say, and you guys don't understand me. Yeah, it was almost, we were that particle that's trying to be one thing, and whilst being aesthetically, the sense that comes around was something different, and it is not a critique, it is an observation, please.
Okay, so this is why I was a little bit frustrated with Blake earlier, and I probably shouldn't have jumped up and down, but what have I done here?
Like, yeah, okay.
I spent 3 hours giving you a map, and it's, to be told that is totalizing.
Yeah.
It's not.
What I'm trying to say is that because of the way that it was done, was a totalizing way.
But like, no. This is where I completely disagree.
It made it sense.
No. People have this weird idea that being systematic is being totalizing.
No, it's not about that.
Why is it totalizing?
Sorry?
Why is it totalizing?
Because the way you describe it, the way you, because negotiation is not yet navigation, and you use navigation.
Okay, let me take those two terms.
Sorry?
Let me take those two terms. Okay. We need to finish, so I'm just going to finish on negotiation versus navigation. Precisely because I briefly earlier described, I have this kind of wider conception of communication. And I explained implication and connotation, and I didn't explain the third word, negotiation.
Okay.
And the important thing about negotiation, as far as I see it, is it is actually the real outside of the representational practice.
Of course, that's why I was interested.
But the reason it's the outside is because it is language use as pure information communication, as social negotiation. So there are ways of signalling.
Confabulation.
There are ways of signalling one another, which enable you to get about going about what you're doing without necessarily representing. You can negotiate the social field, right, using appropriate signals. And in fact, there are certain people who are incredibly good at doing this through through using words that, within context, have very little meaning. This is why I'm interested in jargon. Jargon is a fantastic example of language in which it's non-representational. All it does is enable you to fit into, well, not all it does, but what it principally does is enable you to fit in with a certain set of social relations, to work your way through certain social dynamics. That's negotiation. And if we were negotiating here rather than navigating, we wouldn't be doing philosophy. We wouldn't be talking about anything. To navigate is to represent, is to talk about, right? If we were just negotiating, we might come away thinking we understood things. I might be able to give you a kind of spiel in which I appropriately take all of your personal theoretical historical boxes and make you feel good about yourself. That's not what I'm here for.
Far too much.
No.
So
and representation is about language, not code. And the language is negotiation.
It's not just negotiation. I mean, for example, negotiation here as non-representation. There's something that's, you know, in some ways looks like dialogue and debate, but which fewer emphasizing the non-representational, more quantitative or motive aspects of the dialogue. Like if you send someone in to do hostage negotiation. You don't send them in to present a cogent moral argument against hostage taking. This will get people killed. Mm-hmm. You know, to the extent that someone goes in and does sort of invoke, like, you know, moralistic things there, it's because they've done their homework and they think you're like, this guy with the hostages, you know, he's kind of overbearing, like, priest to my father, and like that I can hit those nerves in order to do it. Like, you're using the arguments for their motive purpose. Everything would be everything in this type of negotiation, in this sense, subordinated to kind of, you know, producing these emotional facts. So that's what
we're talking about.
Well, again,
otherwise, what
are we talking about debate? Or are we talking about debate and discussion? This is a very different thing.
A discussion is negotiation.
It's one of the aspects. We're saying that negotiation is
Sorry?
You mean
non-representational? It is not representational in the sense that you do not know where you are all the time. Yeah,
but Bresser's whole point about navigation is that the need for navigation is that you don't know where you are.
Actually something that I think was wrong. Yeah, that the need of and that's why also the metaphor that was used is better, which was like I thought mistaken in the sense that a desert is that I don't know if you've been to the desert and navigated through the desert, but it is actually a place that you do know where you are. You want to make sure that very well that you know where you are.
It's not actually people who have mastered desert, so this is selection.
But I suppose I just think that you don't know what we're talking about in terms of navigation.
The question is, if we fix the term negotiation, debate, dialogue, emancipation, will we country sort of step forward? This talk, in its recursive going on, somehow shows that the tendency to end up at the lexicological level, at the lexicon, so I mean, the full wisdom, what I do, we understand on the negotiation level. Of course, I understand something extremely different under dialogue, and I would protest to say that a dialogue is a direct reference because there are more productive understandings of
what you really said. Advocate any possibility of reference. It's like navigating in a thick fog where nobody knows what each other's saying. Everyone's saying something, there's no possibility of disagreement.
Let's end on that point of the impossibility of disagreement. Sorry if this has been a bit confusing, but the map is still here, and maybe it'll help people navigate their way through.